morning, colleagues. Welcome to today is 11 August 2022. We continue with our inquiry. Just want to take the opportunity again to welcome all the members at M46 here and on the virtual platform, to welcome the public protector and her legal team led by Advocate Mpofu. Welcome the evidence leaders, Advocates Mayosi and Advocate Bawa, members of the media. Last but not least, the members of the public who have been with us with interest from day one. All of you are welcome. We will start with Advocate Bawa, who might be having a few minutes late entry of the witness for a very good reason. But I will now take this opportunity and hand over to Advocate Bawa.
Good morning. The witness scheduled for today is Advocate Nshenye Radhani. He's been unavoidably detained this morning, and we're hoping that he is going to be not detained.
He's not a convicted
criminal of any kind. Please, before we go down the wrong path, he has a commitment which has taken some sort of precedence over. Well, maybe let me not even go down that path. He has another commitment that he has to attend to, which was quite urgent, and so we are hoping that he's going to be joining us during the course of this morning. He is evidently late to the Frere Dairy report, and so what I'm going to start with, as I did yesterday, is take you through the High Court judgment in the Frere Dairy matter on the merits. To do that, there is a subsequent judgment dealing with costs, which was then overturned on appeal. But I simply want to deal with the merits and make some observation on that judgment in that regard. Chair, through you.
Just before I allow you to continue, just to check if our connections are working. Nemazinga Shabalala.
Recording in progress.
Nemazinga Chabalala, can you hear us? Exposed. Ompile Mautwe, can you hear us?
Yes, sir. Good morning. I can hear you.
Morning, Honorable Mautwe. Welcome. So we are connected. Thank you. Please proceed. Advocate Bawa.
Can I start? Okay. So if I'm just going to ask for them to put the judgment on the screen, and I'm not going to read it verbatim or take you through it, but there are just specific things I want to highlight. And maybe you would have been aware through the evidence, both that had been led already and which is still to come, that we have dealt with various versions of drafts of the Frere report. But what was before the court was two versions. One, which was a 2014 version, and at some point we'll deal with the genesis of that version, and the final report. So the judgment must be seen in the context of there were only two reports before the court. And the background to the case was that the Democratic Alliance and the Council for the Advancement of South African Constitution launched applications based on the same facts. And they sought to review and set aside the public protector's report, which she had released on 8 February 2018, titled Allegations of Maladministration Against the Free State Department of Agriculture, what we commonly call the Frieda Report. And this review was sought on the basis that it was alleged that she had acted unlawfully and in violation of a constitutional mandate under the Constitution and the provisions of the Public Protector Act. The report was, as we know, the complaint had emerged in 2013, and the judgment detailed that it was a culmination of nearly 4 years of investigation by both the incumbent and her predecessor into allegations of widespread corruption, maladministration, and impropriety in respect of the project. Now, what the court did was the Frieda Dairy matter at the High Court was sort of in the same period as the Absa Bank matter. And so the court delivered a judgment on the merits, and it postponed its judgment relating to costs until the Constitutional Court had handed down its judgment in the Absa matter. And so there are two judgments by Ptolemy J in this matter. What had also happened in the meantime, which was sort of after the Absa matter and before this judgment came out, was that the Supreme Court of Appeal had handed down a decision in a case called Minister of Home Affairs and Another versus Public Protector. And you will recall that yesterday I said to you that the applications had been brought on the basis of the provisions of PAJA, the Promotion of Administrative Justice Act, alternatively the principle of legality. And by the time the Frieda Dairy matter came to be considered, the Supreme Court of Appeal had held that effectively the review of a public protector's report must be determined under the principles and the grounds of legality on the basis when you review it. So although the case was again pleaded on the basis of PAJA, alternatively the principle of legality, the applicants, now informed by the Supreme Court of Appeals decision, relied only on the pleaded grounds of legality when this review matter was considered. The public protector initially filed a notice to abide, but in due course filed answering affidavits, which contained what the court described a full-blown attack on the merits of the applications. In other words, the relief being sought by the applicants was opposed. Now, the genesis of the report was effectively a complaint that had been lodged, and the factual background related to the Free State Department of Agriculture having launched a provincial policy intervention which was aimed at revitalizing the Free State agricultural sector through investments in various initiatives. And the project was in question was identified as a flagship intended to uplift the Frieda community through sustainable job creation opportunities. And during April 2012, a company called Estina Pty Limited submitted a business proposal for the management of the project at a farm. It represented, which would later turn out to be falsely, that it was in partnership with an Indian company, Paras, which allegedly had the necessary technical expertise. And the department submitted a request for approval to accept this business proposal and to enter into an agreement with Estina for the establishment and management of this project. Newspapers then subsequently published articles about the project in 2013, linking it to the Gupta family. And during October 2013, the National Treasury investigated the contracts, and some of the findings were disclosed by the media after a leaked transcript of an interview emerged. And the report by Treasury was at that stage not made public, and the media had reported certain irregularities in respect thereof. So that had occurred in 2013. By 2017, and you will recall that by 2017, there had already been several drafts of the Frieda Dairy report having circulated. What we now know is the Gupta leak emails emerged dealing with state and politicians, commonly known as the Gupta leaks. These emails were reported on at length in the media, And they corroborated the early 2013 reports that the project was tainted not only by serious irregularities, but possibly also corruption. And so the court recorded that during mid-2017, more than 6 months before the PPA released their report, three further investigative reports were published in the media based on the Gupta leaks, providing evidence of alleged irregularities and possibly corruption linked to the project, and that the report sought to illustrate that the Gupta family exercised control over the project and that millions of taxpayers' monies were pilfered from the public purse. The reports alleged that senior provincial officials, including the HOD, the MEC, and the Premier, may have been complicit in the wrongdoing. So the Treasury had commissioned an investigation into the department's contracts with Estina and provided a report in which it had made the following findings. And those findings one sees from paragraph 15 of the judgment. Right? And this report was ultimately available to the Public Protector's Office. We know that from what emerges from the judgment and the reports. In light of these findings, the Treasury then made certain recommendations on disciplinary action to be taken. And that was the background of the... And then between 2013 and 2016, a member representing the DA in the Free State Provincial Legislature, who was the complainant, lodged a series of complaints of the Public Protector. There were three complaints. The first and the second complaint is dealt with in the report, which is the subject of the review application. The third complaint was not dealt with. We know that the third complaint is dealt with in a subsequent report that the Public Protector later comes out was in 2020. And Advocate Mpofu had touched on that report with one of the witnesses that it gave evidence. That report is not the subject matter of the proceedings here, nor has it been raised in the motion, nor the subject matter of the judgment before you, other than its non-consideration of this complaint is dealt with in the judgment. And then the court, in several paragraphs, deals with the powers and duties of the Public Protector, and I think you've heard enough about that for now, so I'm going to skip through that section in its entirety and take you to 41, where paragraph 41 of the judgment, where it deals with the Public Protector's report. And what is interesting, and I think it's relevant because I don't think Advocate Mpofu and I will disagree on this, what the court does is it considers it against the what it sets out as the legal framework of the Public Protector, that the work of the committee would also be considered against the legal framework that it considers. But if one comes to the Public Protector report, it then details that the report was published in February 2018, and the judgment records that it is of importance to note that the provisional report was done by the PP's predecessor, Advocate Madam Sala, as these reports have to be compared within the factual matrix of what occurred in the implementation and execution of the project. A comparison of the findings, conclusions, and proposed remedial action is inevitable. The provisional report was included in the Rule 53 record and was dated November 2014. In paragraph 43, it says, seen within the context of the factual background, the scope of the investigation as identified by the PP seems to be too narrow and seems to ignore the issues raised in the report from Treasury, the media reports, as well as the complaints lodged. There does not seem any logical and legitimate explanation for the narrowing of the scope of the investigation. The PP also recorded in the report that she did not investigate certain issues due, she said, to capacity and financial constraints experienced by our office. And then they detail in the judgment the issues not investigated, i.e. the alleged death of cattle, the issues emanating from the complaints on 10th May 2016, the third complaint, the issue of value for money obtained by the government in terms of the agreements as it was investigated by Treasury, The Gupta leaks, how money was transferred to Estina, spent by Estina, as the director of Priority Crimes was dealing with that issue, and that the matter related to beneficiaries was intended to benefit from the project was not investigated. And her reason for the last one was an alleged lack of information. So the court then records it was not in dispute that the PP did not investigate the DA's third complaint, and it was also not in dispute that the PP had not done the following. One, investigate who the true beneficiaries of the Freedom Dairy Project was, investigate the role played by the MEC, the Premier, the HOD, etc. Consider the allegations that were in the public domain, that's the Gupta leaks. Consider how President Zuma may have abused his position as president to protect and promote officials in the Free State Project to serve the Gupta family, and address the fact that the Free State provincial government under the Premier had failed to implement the National Treasury's recommendations that disciplinary action be taken against the departments, HOD and CFO. The PP also failed to investigate the impact of the project on the so-called farm empowerment partner promoted by Mr. Zwani, or the impact on the approximately 8 beneficiaries who were supposed to have benefited as stakeholders in the project. The decision to limit the scope of the investigation so dramatically was irrational, as it sidestepped all the crucial aspects regarding the complaints and led to a failure on her part to execute her constitutional duty. So in paragraph 48, the court details what in the report it says the PP indicated that on assuming office during October 2016, she took the following steps regarding the investigation of the project. One, she sourced 4 additional documents, held 3 interviews, conducted an inspection in loco, and consulted the website to confirm the details of the company involved. The court then concluded in paragraph 49 that the steps taken were wholly inadequate considering the magnitude and importance of the complaints raised. In paragraph 50, the PP claimed in a report not to have had information relating to the beneficiaries. The court then said, well, during December 2017, the leader of the DA, Mr. Musi Mayamani, attended the office of the PP. He took along several of the beneficiaries to introduce to the PP, and an assistant was requested to take down their contact details to facilitate future engagement. The record shows that the information was obtained and in the possession of the PP and formed part of the Rule 43 record. The DA also furnished the PP with the department's list of intended beneficiaries together with a letter of the complaint from the representatives of the steering committee, and it included the ID numbers, addresses, and cell phones. Despite having access to this information, the court concluded that no effort was made to engage with the beneficiaries, and in an answering affidavit before the court, the blame was laid on the DA because the DA had failed to provide the office with the promised assistance to obtain statements from the beneficiaries. The DA in turn denied and stated that Mr. Mayamani had agreed to assist the PP where possible. It was agreed that Mr. Mayamani's office would be the contact point for communication from the PP, but he had not given an undertaking to obtain statements from the beneficiaries of the PP's office as alleged. Further, that the PP had requested no further assistance from the DA. One would have expected the court concluded her office to request assistance if she needed it, but there was another inexplicable failure on the part of the PP. The court then said in the next paragraph that some of the issues for investigation according to the DA and CAFAC seemed to be narrowed, and several findings and remedial steps proposed were omitted from the final report. And the PP's response in answer to the difference was, whatever the differences in findings may be, they have not had any material effect in the lawful remedial action that I have taken within the powers conferred on me by the Act and the Constitution. So the court doesn't detail, in detail deal with these differences, but deals with the impact of these differences on the legality of the report and the appropriateness of the remedial action proposed by the PP. I don't intend to deal with the substance of the differences in the course of taking you through the judgment. In that regard, so I'm going to skip down and deal with the question of pricing of goods and services from paragraph 76 of the judgment. The court held that the TPA also determined whether the prices of goods and services procured were inflated. On this issue, the provisional report that stated that independent evidence indicated that prices of processing equipment and the cows purchased were considerably higher than market value, which confirmed that proper procurement processes were not followed. It indicated that there was a lack of proper monitoring and control measures were the reasons for the discrepancies noted in the financial statements, which in turn pointed to gross negligence and maladministration, which led to future fruitless expenditure. In the final report, there were no findings of inflated prices and irregular and fruitless expenditure. The revised findings simply read, the allegation that the prices for goods and services procured were inflated, specifically expenses in respect of construction, processing equipment, procurement of cows and administration costs is difficult to determine. The explanation given in the answering affidavit for this conclusion is effectively that the estina did not follow public procurement processes when procuring the services of the service providers, that due to the lack of resources and financial constraints, the public protector was unable to conduct a comprehensive investigation in order to determine the fair market value for goods and services procured, and the public protector was not provided with all the invoices and proof of payments for the goods and services procured by Estina on behalf of the department. The PD's contention to the court was that she was unable to obtain market prices is unsustainable, the court concluded in paragraph 79. There was no reason, as the DA argued, why one of his staff appointed for investigations could not assess the market value. Assessing the market value of the goods procured required obtaining quotations from suppliers. The DA staff performed this task to assess the market value of the cattle procured and furnish this information to the PP in the complaint and second complaint. It seems that the PP chose to simply ignore the information supplied to her and then blame financial constraints for a failure to execute the simple task. I pointed out further that the Treasury report had included a report by a senior economist on the cost and value for money, and that had raised a number of red flags which ought to have been investigated further. So the court then concluded in paragraph 83 that the explanation provided to the court was not satisfactory and that the failure of the PP to execute the constitutional duties in investigating and compiling a credible and comprehensive report points either to a blatant disregard to comply with the constitutional duties and obligations or a concerning lack of understanding of those duties and obligations. The court then considered the explanation of capacity and financial constraints within the bounds of the court dicta. And it said that the PP explained in her affidavits that capacity and financial constraints impeded her officer's capacity to investigate the complaints appropriately. One cannot disregard the fact that the PP's office, as many other state institutions, capacities are often constrained by inadequate financial and other resources. The court's approach to evaluating a defense that budgetary constraints precluded the public functionary from fulfilling its constitutional obligations, it said, was dealt with in the rail commuters case in the Constitutional Court, where it adopted a context-sensitive reasonableness standard. In other words, it inquired whether the functionary had shown that it had taken all reasonable measures within its available resource. It then deals with a court dicta, which I won't read to you. It then looks at a further judgment from the Constitutional Court. And then in paragraph 88, it says, the PP in her answering affidavit did not set out supporting facts to illustrate why a proper investigation could not be accomplished. This made it very difficult to determine whether in this instance this defense should be accepted as a bona fide impediment to her ability to execute her duty. In this instance, there was not only a provisional report by a predecessor, but a report by Treasury that clearly indicated misappropriation of funds on an astronomical scale. There were also countless media reports implicating certain individuals and linking them to the project of state capture. All of these should have assisted the PPNA investigation and should have limited the financial impact of the investigation on the resources. The court then said one must consider whether taking certain steps during the investigation would have had caused a huge financial drain on the resources. It would seem that if one considers the provisional report and the Treasury's report, a huge amount of work had already been done, which would have limited the expenses that had to be incurred to properly and adequately complete the investigation. It identified the most blatant failure to be not having properly investigated the circumstances surrounding the beneficiaries of the project. This she also blamed on the lack of resources. The court pointed out that the PP had the names and telephone numbers of some 20 beneficiaries and some even visited the offices, but no attempt was made to get a statement from any of them. For this, she blamed the DA and said they had undertaken to provide the statements. Leaving the duty in the hands of a political party was totally inappropriate and could potentially have impacted on the impartiality of any statements obtained. Whether the DA did give such an undertaking or not is, in my view, irrelevant, as it was the duty of the PP to follow up and obtain those statements. The beneficiaries were the people who should have taken center stage in this investigation, as they were the people, the vulnerable ones for which the office was specifically created and who were deprived of an opportunity to benefit and better their circumstances. Instead, they were ignored and the interests were relegated to a mere peripheral issue. It is an absolute disgrace that some as yet unidentified people benefited while the poor and marginalized were yet robbed again of an opportunity to better the circumstances. The court then looked at what the exercise to obtain the statements, the court concluded that the exercise to obtain the statements would not have had a significant strain on resources. And in any event, seeing that they were supposed to benefit from the project, any resources that she had should have been spent to obtain the input. She had their particulars, their telephone numbers, and one would have expected the office at least to have contacted them or to have attempted to obtain statements from them. Their story had not been told, neither did they benefit from this project, yet $340 million was spent to entities connected to this project and unknown people were enriched. And this the court regarded as the most significant failure of the PP to execute their constitutional duty in this investigation. The court then further said, in 95, it concludes that whatever the resource constraints were, they could perhaps conceivably explain the narrowing of the scope of the investigation, but not explain and justify the irrational, arbitrary findings and material errors of law in the report or the inappropriate and ineffective investigation executed by the office. One of the issues the court then specifically looked at was whether the PP had a discretion to opt out of conducting an investigation on any issue that is brought to the Office of the Public Protector. That was because there was a suggestion in the answering affidavit that the Public Protector had deferred the investigation. I'm rephrasing that wrong and it's going to come out wrong, so let me rather just read it. The PP in addition stated in the affidavit that she exercised the discretion to opt out and not to investigate. The suggestion in the answering affidavit that she deferred the investigation stood in direct contradiction with the statement that she decided to opt out. The PP contended that she had a very wide discretion under the Act to opt out and not to investigate even those complaints that fall within her jurisdiction. On this basis, the PP contended it was open to her to refuse to investigate the third complaint at all. And the court then said that this wasn't a proper reading of the obligations under the Constitution and the Act, and that she did not have a wide discretion, has claimed to refuse to investigate a complaint that fell within her jurisdiction. The court then considers the relevant provisions, and in 101 points out that the provision confers a discretion on the public protector to determine the format and the procedures to be followed in investing a complaint. It afforded the public protector discretion after a preliminary investigation to determine the merits of the complaint and the manner in which the matter concerned should be dealt with, but that it did not permit the PP to decline to conduct any investigation at all. And in the context of her duties, it would be inconceivable that the PP could have discretion to choose to opt out in the context of the factual background of this case. The court then pointed out that if one looked at the legal provisions, that when the PP received a complaint reporting a matter within a jurisdiction, she must conduct at least a preliminary investigation to determine the merits of the complaint, unless one of the exceptions as provided for under the Act applied. And that only, and one of those exceptions, for example, would be investigations into the judiciary. Only after conducting a preliminary investigation of the merits may she, for good reason, decline to investigate the matter further. Should she find that there is merit in the complaint that requires further investigation, she is obliged to either investigate the matter herself or refer the matter for further investigation to another appropriate authority. Should she choose to undertake a further investigation, she must investigate the matter proactively and effectively. The court then looked at a number of the cases dealing with her duties to conduct an investigation, and then 109 of the judgments pointed out that the report by the public protector did not address the major issues raised in the complaints, nor the numerous indications of irregularities. In this instance, the PP did nothing to assure the public that she had kept an open and inquiring mind and that she had discovered or at least attempted to discover the truth. The court then turned to look at the remedial action proposed by the public protector. And at 111, pointed out that the applicants, both applicants, took issue with the fact that the Premier and the HOD, who were both implicated in the project, were being tasked with taking disciplinary actions, corrective measures, and departmental training to avoid a recurrence of the incidents. The result being that it was left to the Premier, who was himself implicated, to determine who constituted an implicated official. Despite admitting that he was an implicated official, the PP failed to identify Mr. Tabeta, who was the HOD, in the findings as the primary instigator in the scheme and to be held responsible as the accounting officer. Further, that the PP, in order to justify her stance pertaining to the remedial action in respect of the HOD, stated that the executive authority, the MEC, had no power to discipline the provincial HOD. The court then looked at the contending that only the Premier had the power in terms of the Public Service Act to do so. The court then looked at the relevant provisions, came to the conclusion that that conclusion as a matter of law was wrong, and it discusses that in the next paragraph. Secondly, that the PP contended that she referred generally to implicated officials because she wanted to ensure that all officials who worked on the project are not excluded from disciplinary action, but that this did not explain the removal of the specific direction in the provisional report that disciplinary action be taken against the HOD, who played a pivotal role in the alleged irregularities that occurred. And the court then concluded in paragraph 116 that this was inappropriate to put people who are implicated in wrongdoing in a position to investigate the very same wrongdoing, finding that to be absurd and going against every known principle of law and logic. In the provisional report, the PP had directed that the disciplinary action be taken, that the disciplinary action was to be taken by the HOD against the incumbent and implicated HOD, as he was an implicated official. This remedial action was removed by the DP in a final report, and in so doing, she rendered the remedial action that was required to be implemented by the HOD ineffective and irrational. The instructions to the HOD could not be expected to be properly implemented or achieve their purpose unless coupled with a specific requirement that the incumbent HOD be subject to disciplinary action. The court then looked at the third change to the remedial action in comparison to the provisional report, being the removal of the requirement that the Premier and the MEC must ensure that the findings of the Accounting General are noted and that the recommendations as mentioned in his report of January 2013 be implemented. And then in 120 concluded that there was no explanation in the answering papers for the removal of the aforesaid action. The court then looked further at a comparison between what was proposed in the provincial report and the explanation for the removal from the final report. And then in 123 said the Premier's personal involvement in promoting the project and the close association between the Premier and the Gupta associates through his son, who was employed by the Gupta family and the Gupta associates involved in Astina, was reported in the media from as early as 2013. Likewise, Mr. Zwani's direct involvement in facilitating the project and the allegations of kickbacks from the Gupta family was a matter of public record. So the court then said there was no explanation of this failure to investigate, nor a referral, at least to another authority to investigate the allegations in the complainant's third complaint, which we've already dealt with. And it then deals with an explanation as to why the remedial action in respect of the SIU had been overtaken, was removed, and the explanation being that it had been overtaken by events. The court then concludes in paragraph 127 deals with the fact that the justification for not dealing with the third complaint was that it was too late to do so. And the court then pointed out that the complaint was made in May 2016 and the final report was only issued in February 2018. So it was inconceivable that having regard to the dates to have concluded that it was too late to consider it. With reference to the to the SIU investigation, if one goes to 132, there was at some point a suggestion that it be referred that the remedial action involved the SIU and the Auditor General in the provisional report, and this was removed, and the explanation given was because the PP considered that she did not have the power to instruct either of them to conduct an investigation on her behalf. And they pointed out that that remedial action was successfully challenged on review in the matter of Absa Bank, but that judgment was only given on 16 February 2018 after the report was published. And in the Absa proceedings, the PP had defended the remedial action as being within her powers. Paragraph 137, they concluded that the PP was clearly empowered to refer matters to the SIU for investigation because it was specifically provided under the provisions of the SIU Act, but that the effect of the Absa Bank decision was that it was not open to the PP to instruct the SIU how to exercise its powers as she had purported to do in the report in that matter. As regards the Treasury report, the PP contended that the remedial action directed that this office in the provisional report was incompetent because the Auditor General does audits of accounts and financial statements and not forensic and due diligence investigations. The court then concluded that in this regard, the PP had, that the Auditor General was vested with special investigative powers and that it was an incorrect legal interpretation to have come to that conclusion. do that. The court then considered this to be an error in law in suggesting that she didn't have the power to ask the Auditor General to do this, and pointed out in 145 that the evidence suggests that she was aware that she possessed the power, but elected nevertheless to exclude the remedial action. And so the court then concluded that the remedial action in the report was not an effective remedial action. I didn't redress or undo prejudice, impropriety, unlawful enrichment of corruption that occurred during the project, and it then concluded that the report should be set aside, reviewed and set aside. In that regard. So this judgment, as you see from 160 of the judgment, simply dealt with the order on the merits relating to reviewing and setting aside the order. The court then awaited the further judgment of the Absa Bank in respect of costs. And if one then sees the judge hands down a different order in respect of when it deals with the cost award, which is judgment number 34 in the bundle. Just want to go to paragraph 31. Where the public protector, where the order was that the office was to pay 85% of the cost of the Democratic Alliance on an attorney-client scale, including the cost of two counsel, the public for both the DA and CASAC. In that regard, and then the public protector in a personal capacity was ordered to pay the 7.5% of the costs in that regard. Now, as I understand it, and my junior has already taken you through it, my co-evidence leader, sorry.
Did you say who?
Advocate Mayosi. No.
Something like junior?
No, co-evidence leader. You heard me wrong.
Oh, okay.
Absolutely not. I would never make such a statement. The leave to appeal against both judgments was refused, and I don't think the matter was taken any further as far as we've been able to ascertain. So there is no constitutional court or SCA judgment beyond this judgment in the Freire matter. Thank you, Chief.
To Advocate Bauer. Maybe at that point, if you can also just indicate how far we are in getting the witness in.
Chair, I was expecting a WhatsApp as soon as he's ready.
Okay.
Can we just adjourn for 5 minutes and I'll go and make a call and see if I can track him down?
No problem. We'll take a 10-minute break. Thank you.
Recording stopped.
Tended to waiting for the witness who's driving to a proper place to connect. So please be patient. We might have to start at 20 past or half past 11. Asking for that patience also in the virtual. Thank you.
We will be patient.
Recording in progress.
Welcome back, colleagues and everybody. Thank you for your patience and our apologies for keeping you waiting. It was something a bit out of our control. that we have to manage. We're now going to proceed, and I'm going to recognize Ms. Fatima Ibrahim, and I'm going to ask Advocate Bauer to just switch off her mic. Advocate Bauer, thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson.
Just wait.
Yeah, I think I'm in now.
Yeah. Can you hear us?
Yeah, I can hear you, Jay.
Okay. Thank you very much. I'm now going to recognize Ms. Fatima Ibrahim, who will do the preliminaries. And I'm going to urge her that when she comes to the oath and affirmation, that she does that slowly. She seems to be fast, and there's a lot of trip that the witnesses get into that space. Over to you, Ms. Fatima Ibrahim.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning, Advocate Jaidani. Can you hear me clearly?
Morning.
Advocate Jaidani, can you please state your full name for the record?
Can you hear us? The journey?
Yes, Chair, I can hear you.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. But I can't hear
Advocate
Bauer.
It's Ms. Fatima Ibrahim. I hand over to her. Let's see if you can hear her, Ms. Ibrahim.
Good morning, Mr. Jaidani. Can you hear me now?
Yes, I can hear you.
Can you please state your full name for the record?
My name is Ndicheni Jaidani.
Advocate Jaidani, you have been invited subject to the provisions of Section 16 of the Powers, Privileges and Immunities of Parliament and Provincial Legislatures Act 2004 to appear before this committee as a witness and to answer questions in respect of the committee's inquiry into the removal of the public protector, Advocate Mkwebane. Please be informed that by law you are required to answer fully and satisfactorily all the questions lawfully put to you or to produce any document that you are required to produce in connection with the subject matter of this inquiry, notwithstanding the fact that the answer or the document could incriminate you
or expose you to criminal or civil proceedings or damages. You are, however, protected in that evidence given under oath or affirmation before a House or committee may not be used against you in any court or place outside of Parliament, except in criminal proceedings concerning a charge of perjury or a charge relating to the evidence or documents required in these proceedings. Please be aware further that in terms of Section 17(2) of the Powers Act, a person who willfully furnishes a House or committee with information or makes a statement before it which is false or misleading commits an offence and is liable to a fine or imprisonment for a period not exceeding 2 years. You will now be required to take an oath or to affirm that the evidence you are about to give is truthful. Which do you prefer, the oath or the affirmation?
Yeah, the oath is fine, Ms. Bauer.
May I ask that you raise your right hand and repeat after me, please? I swear that the evidence I shall give.
I swear that the evidence I shall give.
Shall be the truth.
Be the truth.
The whole truth.
The whole truth.
And nothing but the truth.
And nothing but the truth.
The truth. And nothing but the truth.
And nothing but the truth.
So help me God.
So help me God.
Thank you, Chair. The witness is now duly sworn in.
Thank you, Ms. Fatima Ibrahim, and thank you, Mr. Raidani and the chairman. As we go along, we will monitor your network. At some point, if we can hear you properly, we'll ask you to switch off the camera, but let's see how it works. I will now recognize Advocate Bauer.
Good morning, Advocate Raidani.
Morning, Advocate Bauer.
You provided us with an affidavit, correct?
Yes, I did.
And for the committee's reference, the affidavit is in bundle D and it starts at page 2758. And we're going to have the affidavit on the screen, Mr. Chair, through you. So if it is better for Advocate Raidani to have his screen off, then it's not going to make a difference because we're not going to be able to see.
For now, you can switch off your camera so that you save your... Go ahead, Advocate Bauer.
Mr. Raidani, you're currently a practicing advocate and a member of the Limpopo and Janet Fibbs Bar, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Hi. You left the employ of the Public Protector's Office in December 2018, correct?
18th, Chairperson.
And you haven't had access to any emails or documentation from the Office of the Public Protector after you had left, correct?
Yes, because I ended my...
Now, you were employed, if I take you to paragraph 5, you were employed at the office from October 2018 to December 2018. You had worked from investigator to senior investigator and various parts in the organization, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
And in 2017, you were transferred to the office of the then Public Protector Advocate in Kobani, which was known as the private office.
Yes.
Right, and in that space you were involved together with others in dealing with quality assurance. In fact, your team comprised of Advocate Matlawi, Mr. Kikana, Ms. Sifoko as a junior investigator, and later Mr. Mundu Sitolu, who was then a very junior member of the team, joined you, correct?
Yes. That's
you also
correct.
Had a trainee investigator who reported to you.
Yes, I did.
Then data in
I think you just need to be much slower than you are. so that you can allow him to complete his sentences.
My apologies, Advocate Sudani. You set out in paragraph 7 what the quality assurance functions are. Is that so?
Correct.
Right, and then you point out in paragraph 9 or rather in paragraph 8, let me not jump the gun, let me slow it down a bit, that sometimes you would only consider the report and at other times you would consider that due to the nature of the case, you would consider not only the report, but also the supporting affidavits.
That's correct.
And we'll come to the further investigation in a while, but there you had the file of evidence and the supporting documentation. Correct?
Correct.
Over and above working in the PP's office, you were also involved in union activities and you were a shop steward.
Yes, I have been a shop steward for as long as I can remember when I was in the PPSA.
Right. And you left the office in order to go and do pupillage because you wanted to become an advocate.
Yes, that's correct.
I don't know why you wanted to do that job, Mr. Tsani, really. And so you had applied for pupillage midway through 2018, correct?
Yeah, that should be somewhere in June, July 2018.
Yeah. And you didn't leave the Public Protector's Office under a cloud of any kind, did you?
Yeah, I was not under any facing any disciplinary charges. I left the office out of my own will.
Right. So all right. I want to take you to paragraph 19. You never had any personal agreements, disagreements with the PP either. Correct?
Yeah, no, I never had any personal disagreements or personal quarrel or a fight or anything with the current public project.
Hi. Okay. You then deal with what you regarded as being changes at the Office of the Public Protector, and we've heard others testify about the think tank structure being changed, so I'm not going to take you any detail of that because the committee's already had that evidence and they've asked a number of questions on it, but you deal with that in your affidavit. And you, in paragraph 25, point out that the process was replaced by a smaller committee which you didn't regard as being adequate. Can you just elaborate on that? In paragraph 25.1, you set out your reservations of how that committee was then comprised.
On paragraph 25.1 to 25.5.
That's correct.
Okay. If, like as stated in my affidavit, the think tank, even though it was not officially announced that it was done away with, but there was a committee which was a dashboard which was comprised of the chief of staff who had no legal qualification, and then it excluded the then deputy public protector, and then it included the former CEO, Mr. Themba Dlamini. And although the CEO, I'm not quite sure about his qualification, whether he was legally qualified, then it sometimes included the former spokesperson. And then it Then there were some of us who were senior investigators attached to quality assurance. It was myself, Advocate Matlawe, Mr. Kekana, and the rest of the team, like Ms. Sifako and Ms. Nandi Muridili then. And then there was also Mrs. Tone. So this committee, it also had, I think the head of legal was also part of it at some point. And also, and then executive managers would come and report to on about the investigation that they are currently conducting. And then as they report, we will then they will report to PP. PP will then give direction. And if then there are some comments from the team, we will give our comments as is in there and there. So I don't know if I have answered your question.
No, you have. Thank you. If I take you to paragraph 26, I think the principle is ultimately accepted, but you pointed out that you accept that the PP ultimately decides what must go into each report that is produced and bears responsibility for such reports that are issued.
Yes, the PP, regardless of whatever that we're discussing as staff members and from various, we can have our comments, our views, but ultimately the public protector is the one who has the final say on what goes into the report, what should be left out, because ultimately she will then take responsibility when the report is issued.
Right. And then you deal with, I'm going to take you to where we start dealing with the FIRA investigation in paragraph 31.
Okay. Yes, I'm on.
Right. Now, you point out that you were part of the team that dealt with the report that was ultimately issued in February 2018.
That's correct.
Right. When did you first become involved?
I received an email, I think it was in November 2017 from my executive manager, who was then Mr. Ndo. I had, from that time in November 2017, I was transferred from the Public Protector's private office to Provincial Investigation Integration. So hence we received instruction from Mr. Ndo that we should form part of the task team that will complete the Free Idea investigation report.
Right. When you say task team, this is sort of an ad hoc committee set up to finalize the Free Idea report and not necessarily the task team that was meeting on a weekly basis, correct?
Yes, that was the team, I would say, the team that was called in by Mr. Ndo from its business unit for us to assist him to complete the FIRA investigation report, as I think it was a directive from the PP that he should appoint that ad hoc committee.
And you were provided with a file that had been handed over from the Provincial Investigations Branch to the head office, correct?
Yes, I was given all the files of the Free Idea investigation. I think it was a number of the arch liver files. So it was original files that I was given for the purposes of completing this task.
Right. So then on 16th November, in paragraph 35, you detail and email that you received, and the email is actually attached as NR1, but it's quoted in your affidavit. Is this the email that you're referring to, you received from Mr. Ndo?
Yes, this is the email that I received from Mr. Ndo.
And if I can just read it quickly. You're aware that the public protector has approved the task team to finalize the fair dairy report matter. Attached here to is the final version of the report, copies of letters directed to the Ministers Agriculture and DTI, copy of a letter directed to the Premier Free State, legal opinion from the MSCC pertaining to the issue of the nature of the project, whether it's a PPP or not. At that stage, Mr. Nemesisi was the, what was he, senior manager legal services?
Yes, he was the head of legal, senior manager legal services.
Fine. And it says Joanna will provide you with copies of files with invoices received from the Premier and those received from the Department of Agriculture. The latter are contained in the cream white archive of files. The public protector's instructions are the following. To write reminders to the two ministers for a signature, her view is that, we have requested from the two ministers will give us a good idea of our project, such as Frieda. Project should be run properly and then benchmark Frieda against that. To do a comparison of the two sets of invoices to see if payments were done in after submission of proper invoices. You will notice in the report that there is just a one-liner about the Gupta emails. I raised the issue with the public protector but did not receive a response. When I checked the Umabungani website, there are various allegations pertaining to monies for this project. For example, the allegations that 84 million was siphoned off to a Gupta offshore account and that the Gupta wedding in Sun City was paid for from funds in this project. So, Mr. Radani, you were aware of the issue of the Gupta leaks from the start of when you became involved in finalizing this report, correct?
Yes, I was aware.
Now, in paragraph 36, you point out that the PP was adamant that those should not be included in the investigation. You see that?
Yes.
How did you come to know this?
I think this came out of my interactions with Ms. Tendo, because at some point I remember we wrote a memorandum as the task team that one of the things that we needed to look at was the Gupta leaks emails and see if we cannot incorporate them into the report. And then one of the things, there was some outstanding information that was supposed to be submitted by the beneficiaries, the statement of the beneficiaries. So in that memorandum that I wrote in January, it's some of the issues that we said it's gonna we need that to happen in order for us to finalize the investigation properly. But after submitting that particular memorandum, we never received any feedback from the PP regarding the issues that we raised. And hence, I will say that from what I've learned from Mr. Ndo and then my former manager, it was Mr. Mutupi, it was that the PP doesn't want the Gupta emails, the Amabungane emails and emails to be included in the investigation.
If we don't jump to January, let's see if we can get through the chronology, which then follows in your affidavit, and then we'll come to the memo in January in a bit. You were aware that at that stage the Section 7(9) notices had been sent and the responses had already been received, correct?
Yes, everything was in the file.
Right, and there had been numerous versions of the draft report that had previously been circulated.
Yes, the way.
Right. And so the report that was provided to you at that stage is the one which is annexed to your affidavit marked NR2, which you'll see at page 2784. And although it was headed September 2017, you got this in November 2017, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Right. And you say in paragraph 39 of your affidavit that it had some of Mr. Doe's edits in it, and the findings therein were largely the same as those set out in an earlier version of the report, which has been circulated in September.
Yes, that's correct.
All right. And we then provided you with an email correspondence of September 2017, which included that report, which is which parts of it is annexed to your affidavit marked NR3.
Yes, that's correct.
Right. Now, you say in your affidavit that the September 2017 report had concluded that the accounting officer was guilty of financial misconduct in respect of the inflated prices for animals, equipment, and infrastructure, but that the one you received did not have that finding.
That's correct.
So if I take you to page 2870, 1 sees, sorry, let me just give our operator an opportunity to catch up. It's NR3 at 2870. Sorry, I'll remember to tell you where to go. Right? And I'm looking at paragraph double E.
Paragraph double E, I can see double D there, which went. Okay.
Ryan, that's the paragraph that says the conduct of the head of the department constitutes an act of financial misconduct as envisaged by 81 of the PFMA. Right?
Yes.
And if I jump back to NR2 and I take you to 2858. And we look at paragraph 6.3.5, you will see that, that paragraph in the section is not there.
Yes.
Right? Okay. So you then say that, do you know how that came to be omitted? If you go back to your affidavit at paragraph 40.
Yeah, I don't really know what happened and who instructed that that particular paragraph should be omitted from the later version.
Right. So you say in paragraph 41 that from the evidence you had available, you could make findings that the then Premier and MEC had taken no steps to put into effect the recommendations of the National Treasury in respect of the procurement irregularities.
Yes, the National Treasury report was very clear on the about what the Premier and the MEC was supposed to do in terms of preventing any further financial irregularities.
Right. And you seem to have recalled that at some point there were findings against them. Can you recall that?
Yes, there were. 41.2? Yes, there were.
Okay. Now, there was a meeting with Mr. Mayamani that took place at the end of 2017. Were you present at that meeting?
Yes, I was present in that meeting.
And did he it says in paragraph 42 that he came with some of the beneficiaries. And do you recall what was what the meeting was about?
The meeting was mainly about the delay in finalizing the investigation. Basically, Mr. Maimane, on behalf of the beneficiaries, was worried that we were taking long to complete the investigation. So basically, it was your normal feedback meeting that you will have with the complainant in a normal situation where there is a complainant who is prejudiced about a certain issue that he reported to the public protector.
And you then sign the affidavit that Mr. Maimani undertook to provide details and statements from the beneficiaries.
Yes, he did.
And do you recall if that was ever provided?
I can't recall if we did that information was submitted to the office, because by the time we finalized the investigation, that information was still outstanding.
Right. And there was an undertaking given in that meeting that the RIP would come out within a few months, correct?
Yes. Yes, that's correct.
Right. Then, if we go to your next paragraph, this is the memorandum that you referred to earlier.
Yes.
And this is a memorandum which it comes under cover of an email which you see in NR4@2873.
Yes.
It's addressed by Mr. Kekana, and it's on the 25th of January to Mr. Ndou, yourself, and Mr. Sitoli. This memorandum, was it prepared by all of you?
Yes, it was prepared by, it should be myself, Kekana, and Sitoli.
Right. And in essence, view that is expressed in the memorandum sets out various aspects of it, and then on page details the investigation, and on page 40. Well, I just can't find the exact page, but you say in paragraph 45 of your affidavit that the task team views were, and if you can just take us through 45.1 and the sub numbers at the time.
45.1
of your affidavit at 2772.
Okay. 45.1, it was our view that the conclusion of the agreement between the department and Stina was not in line with the relevant procurement prescripts, more specifically section 217 of the Constitution. Then basically it follows that the conduct of the accounting officer in question was improper, because he failed to ensure that when the agreement was concluded, it complied with the relevant transcripts. And then it was clear that the prices of goods, services for construction and the processing equipment and procurement of cows and the administration cost were inflated. Because if you maybe had a look on the versions of the report, there is one version with a guardhouse and also the milking equipment there. The guardhouse that was indicated there, it's something that is it's not out of ordinary. It can't cost the price that apparently they claim that it cost millions. And then there were when I read through the versions of the reports, we could clearly identify that the Free State office during the investigation, they have acquired the services of I think it was an economic somebody who has understanding in economics, and he did a comparison, and he concluded that the prices were really inflated and they were considerably higher than the prevailing market prices. So this was the view of the task team at that particular point in time in January 2018.
So, Mr. Dani, I found the reference I was looking for. It was a summary of your analysis of the evidence in your memo to be found at 2886 and 2887 of NR4. We won't go there because you've now summed it up. But in this memo, you also noted that various aspects of the investigation still had to be conducted. And that you detail at 2887 of the memo. It's repeated in paragraph 46 of your affidavit that you still needed to consider submission from the Premier's office, a legal opinion regarding the public-private partnership. That was an opinion prepared by Mr. Nemasisi, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
And then evaluate the evidence in respect of the project's intended beneficiaries, and you were still awaiting evidence from Mr. Maimani.
Yes, that's correct.
And your approach then was you were of the view that the report could be submitted for consideration.
At that particular point, I think our view was we wanted the memo to be submitted for consideration, raising like all the issues that I raised in paragraph 46 and in the memo. We felt that if these issues are addressed, then the report will be can be ready to be released.
Okay. And then in paragraph 48, you talk about what transpires on the week of the 5th of February. Can you just tell us what occurred?
I think it was on this week, we were summoned. We were summoned by Mr. Ndou. It was me, my advocate Matlawe, and Mr. Kekar. And then Mr. Ndou advised us that the PP want to sign the Friday report. I think this was shortly after we've submitted the memorandum that I referred to earlier on. And while we're still waiting for an answer on the issues that we raised there, as I stated in paragraph 46, we were then called to this meeting. Then Mr. Ndou, he said to us the PP wanted to sign the Friday report shortly, and we were instructed to go and finalize the Friday report regardless of the issues that we raised, which we thought they were outstanding. And then we went to work on the report. Especially what we did was just to do quality assurance to make sure that the report and the evidence that has been presented, there is a relationship between the two. Then we submitted the report back, I think it was to Mr. Ndou. Then the draft was then circulated to Mr. Nemasisi. Then Mr. Nemasisi made the comments on it. And then it came back on the very same week.
Okay.
And it was just a pause
before we proceed. Can I ask you that you put your phone on silent? So because every time there's a message getting into your phone, it's so loud that we can hear it. Are you winning? Is it now on silent? Mr. Raidani?
Oh, okay, can I proceed?
Yes,
thank
I have you put your phone on silence. Did you hear me?
My phone.
Yeah.
Chair, are you referring to my phone?
Yes. Can you put it on silent?
It is on silent.
Okay. It's somebody's phone that is really not helping us. We'll check.
My phone is on silent.
Okay.
Let me just double.
Thank
yeah,
you.
It is on.
All right. Advocate Bauer, proceed.
Okay. If we go to paragraph 49 of your affidavit, you were at the point where you said the draft was circulated to Mr. Nemasisi. You say there that he usually provided input into the process.
Yes. Chairperson, what happened is we never had that position of a legal of the head of legal having an incumbent in the organization. It was the first time that Mr. Nemasisi was employed in that position. So I think it was in his first year. So as a new trend that I saw developing in the organization, it was that once we have that we are done with the report as investigators from the investigation branches, we'll then circulate it to Mr. Nemasisi, who will look at it objectively in order to determine if that particular report is reviewable or not. So what happened in this instance is it was as part of the trend or the developing culture in the organization. The report was then sent to Nemasisi to have a look at it in order to advise us if it's reviewable or not.
In paragraph 50, you say that you were called into a meeting with the public protector. Can you tell us about that?
That meeting, if I remember correctly, the acting chief of staff, she sent an email. It was to me, Kekana, Matlawe, and Nemasis, wherein she said, and Mr. Ndo, I think so, he was included, wherein she said that the PP want to see us regarding that report. She was not happy. She wanted us to meet in the morning. In the morning, I can't remember the date, but it was between the 5th and the 8th, before the 8th, when the report was initially. Then we went to meet the PP. And when we went to meet the PP, it was myself, Mr. Kekana. Mr. Ndo was on leave. And I think the third person should be Mr. Nemasisi, and then the acting chief of staff. In that meeting, the PP indicated her displeasures when it comes to the readiness of the report. She was not happy. She instructed us to go and implement certain changes in the report. And it was in that meeting that I left together with Mr. Kekana, and we went back to our offices, and we carried out the instructions and as instructed by the PT, and amended the report as per instruction.
Right. So you say Mr. Ndo was on leave for part of that week, and you say Mr. Toley and Advocate Matlawi, although they were part of the task team, they were not very much involved in that process going forward.
Yes, they were not very much involved, because if I remember, Mr. Matlawi was not even in the meeting. It was me and Kekana who went to meet the public protector. And in terms of seniority and then our involvement in the report, we were the only ones who were senior to be able to carry out the PP's instructions.
Okay, so if we look at your next paragraph, you say that Mr. Kikana then circulated a draft of the FIREDA report to yourself, Mr. Matlawi and Mr. Nemasisi, as well as Ms. Cleopatra Mosana. She was then the PP spokesperson, right?
Yes, she was the PP spokesperson.
And he then attached certain amendments that he made and asked you to include those amendments, your amendments to it.
Yes.
Right. If you go to NR5, which is at 2890, you then see the email that you get at the 8th. So if we see this, Mr. Radani, Thursday was the 8th, so that would have meant the 5th was the Monday. So it was at the start of the week on the Monday that this process commenced. So we now in Thursday, and you provided with certain amendments to certain sections at 17 minutes past 4, and then we go up on this email. You see Mr. Kakana tells you you must work on a version that he sent, and then he says he notices that paragraphs in the remedial action was not deleted to do that. And then you say that if you go back to 53 of your report, Mr. Kakana then you mentioned the version that he circulates at 1635, and that version is then attached to your affidavit marked NR5, and he then sends you another version which you see at 2891, which is what you call the Kikana version, which then contains certain track changes made by him and Mr. Nemasisi.
Yes. Right?
So if we look at your affidavit just in conjunction with that, and I'll take you to that briefly. You say at 54.1 that you say at 54.1 that for the first time the report records that certain issues were not investigated due to capacity and financial constraints, including the issues emanating from the complaint on 10th May, how the money was spent by Stina, and that the beneficiaries were who the beneficiaries were in the Gupta leaks. And then if I take you to the next one, you say that under the heading of issues that were not investigated were the recordals that the complaint did not have allegations against the former MEC Free State Department of Agriculture, nor against the then Premier, Mr. Magashulu. If we could go to NR6, at page 2899. We go down to Roman numeral 8. You see that it says the following issues were not investigated due to capacity and financial constraints experienced by the office. Is that what you were referring to, Mr. Adani?
Yes, that's correct.
Right. And if we go to B, you see issues emanating from the complainant sent on 10th May as the issues pertaining were identified. And then further down, you see the reference inserted in respect of referring to the Gupta family. Yeah. Right. And if you go to 2900. You see in G and H, it states that the complaint did not have allegations against the former MEC, and the complaint did not raise allegations against the Premier. And the last one is at page 2902. That the report notable changes were made in respect of removing the findings. We can go back to your affidavit at 2775, paragraph 54 and 5. Notable changes were including removing the findings of gross irregularity, improper conduct, abuse of power, infringement of the constitution and maladministration in respect of accounting officers' procurement activities. And whereas the previous versions of the draft had recorded that the department had failed to comply with applicable procurement prescripts, it now concluded that the department had never entered into a public-private partnership. Can you tell us how these changes, how it came about that these changes were being made?
The changes, as you have referred to in general, in the report. Okay. These changes, whatever that came out of the earlier version that we submitted earlier in the week, the meeting that we had with the public protector and Mr. Kekana and Nemesis, this is where we were instructed to factor those changes. This is what Mr. Kekana, on the morning of the 8th, and myself, when we went back to our offices, as you have seen from his email, I was working on a separate, we segregated the issues. He worked on certain issues, I worked on certain issues. That's when we were effecting these changes as per the instructions from the executive authority.
And so if you go down to paragraphs 56, you say that findings of inflated prices and overcharges were maintained, and in fact Mr. Nemesisi reinserted the finding of financial misconduct.
Yes, that's correct. In the version that he worked on earlier on.
Hi.
On that week actually.
Hi. And just for the record, one sees that at page 2904, we don't have to go there. You then detail further in paragraphs 57 and 58, further changes that were made relating to the section setting out the officer's findings on alleged non-compliance with environmental legislation. That was completely removed. One sees that at page 2905, and then Mr. Nemesisi remained concerned that the office had failed to obtain invoices. Can you recall what that was about?
The environmental legislation compliance. It was in the farm when the Free State colleagues, when they conducted an inspection. Then the Department of Environmental Affairs and the National Department of Water Affairs, they found out apparently about 30 something carcasses of cattle, of cows, were buried alongside in the farms. And they concluded their own investigation, and they instructed the farm manager to make sure that those cows are removed from that mass grave and then be buried somewhere else. So there was nothing from our side as the public protector that we investigated relating to the non-compliance with environmental legislation. So the same thing, that's why Nemesis was concerned, because on the report, on some versions of the report, there was a finding about non-compliance relating to non-compliance with the environmental legislation. And that finding, it simply said, I think it said that the allegations that there was non-compliance with environmental legislation was not substantiated. I think this is why Nemesis was concerned that we have this finding, but we don't discuss it in the report on what did we do. And basically, we just rely on the report from the other department, and then make finding as if we have investigated. Then relating to the second issue of invoices, he was also concerned that we did not obtain invoices and receipts from ESPIN, and then we made findings about this as well.
And if we go to page 2931 of the report, we see that he also had other concerns in a comment along the margin at 2931. It's just, there's a comment which is, if you can see it, the NN in the comment columns is Mr. Nemesisi, is correct?
Yes, that's Mr. N.N. Tsumbedzeni Nemesis.
And he raised the issue there, didn't you interview the head of the department? He's a key witness in this matter, and it will be procedurally fair that we give him the chance to explain. We also have to interview Mr. Kamal Vasran, the director of Estina, as he was the one implementing the project. I also suggest that we obtain the bank statements of project account so that we can make observations on the money laundering. This observation will make the report more credible, as the public is interested on who benefited on the project as opposed to who did not follow the process when appointing. Were those things done, Mr. Radani?
I will take Mr. Because I did not investigate the I was only involved in the finalization of the quality assurance. What Nemesis was raising here is very correct, and I agree with him. Firstly, in order for you to there was a need to interview the head of department and then also the director of ESPIN. So I agree with his comments. So when it comes to whether this was done, I doubt if the accounting officer was interviewed and the director of Estina was also questioned about this.
In fact, if you go back to the report, just move away from the comments into the main report and just go up. You will see he makes this comment in respect of interviews conducted, and that would be where in the report one would see who the investigators had spoken to in respect of compiling the report. Correct?
Yes, they spoke to the head of department. That's where in 4421, and then the chief executive of corporate service, that's the Free State Development Corporation. That was this organization only took over the project when it has failed. So it was not part of it was not much featured in the investigation, as you can see. It just that the relevance of this Free State Development Corporation is just It took over the project when Estina and then the department has failed.
Sorry, continue, Mr. Radhani.
I will presume that when this meeting of the 17th of September happened, whoever was investigating the matter should have interviewed the head of department about the process that was followed when this contract was agreed or was entered into. And at that time, it should have been clear on the investigator that at that particular point, there was non-compliance with procurement prescripts.
So if we then go back to your report, to your affidavit, sorry, paragraph 60 on page 2776, you then circulated another version of the report on that day, and you then attached a further version of the report, and that both the findings of financial misconduct and the findings of prices being inflated, overcharged, were removed.
Yes, that's correct.
And did you remove those?
Yes, when we were editing with Mr. Kekan under the instruction of the public, after the instructions that we received from the public protector, we removed those paragraphs and inserted, like the earlier version of the report with insertion that you showed me, that's when we were actually removing the previous paragraph and putting the new ones.
Okay, so if I take you to that version at NR 8, and I go to pages 2986, one sees the changes done in turquoise or bluish color. Those would be the changes that you had put in.
Yes, I presume so.
Yeah, right. And if we go, just want to take you to page 3037. If you go down. The photographs are also removed.
Yes, we removed it.
Why did you remove it?
It was an instruction that we must remove the photographs from the report.
Then a further version of the report then gets circulated by Mr. Nemasisi, and you refer to that in your affidavit at paragraph 61. And one sees that what Mr. Nemasisi does is he inserts various changes back into the draft.
Yes.
And he notes various concerns in the draft.
Yes.
Were you working in your in the same room? Were you working in your respective offices and you were having an email communication?
I think we're working in different rooms. If Mr. Kekana was in his office in the first floor, I was in my office in my ground in the ground floor, and Nemasisi was in the second floor of the building.
Okay, so I'm not going to take you right now specifically to NR10, but you then detail in paragraph 61.4 the changes which one sees Mr. Nemasisi making on the draft. And he expresses concerns, you point out. Just take us through 61.4 and 5.
Okay, it's again the comment that you referred to earlier, where Nemasisi made comments. So he was concerned that it made no reference to the interview that the accounting officer, which we have gone through the report, and it made reference to that meeting of the 17th of September, I think it was 2013. The director of ESCINA, who we think it's material. And I don't think the report make reference to the interview with the director of ESCINA. And then he suggested that the bank statements should be obtained so that the OPP could make findings in respect of money laundering. So again, this is coming from that comment. And he recorded concern that the Office of the Public Protector has failed to obtain necessary warrants, and that further documents should be at least have been requested from his team. He also pointed out that the report conclusions actually required a finding that there had been non-compliance with environmental transcripts. I think that's what I was explaining earlier on about what Nemasisi was concerned about.
Right, and then after that you receive an email from the acting chief of staff, Ms. Moluleko.
Yes, I received that email. Unfortunately, I was still in the office at that, but it was long after the official knocking off time.
And you see that at page 3136, but it's in your affidavit, and it basically says Mr. Madlawi's gone, the public protector is now alone, and she asked you to assist in checking for her.
Yes.
Right? Checking it for her, she will be back shortly. And there's a question asked as to why there's still comments in the report.
Yes.
Right. And what do you then do?
I think I was then requested to go over to the executive office, where in Linda tried to explain this and saying that the PP wanted to sign the report today, so I must stay behind to assist the PP to finalize the report, since Matau is gone and there is no one else to assist. And I presume by that time Mr. Nemasisi was also in the office, and I think Miss Musana was still around as well.
Right, and what then transpired?
So my first answer to the chief of staff was that Mr. Matlawe should have been the one who consolidated the report and make sure that a clean version of the report, which does not have comments or does not show comments from other from other members of the team, it's submitted to the public protector. Then from there, it was when I went over to the PP's boardroom, and we said initially it was myself, Ms. Musana, the acting chief of staff, and Ms. Mutitsi, who was at the particular time the acting chief executive officer. And from that, we started working on the final version of the report. It was myself with my laptop and the public protector. I think most of the time we were sitting, it was the PP, myself, and the acting chief of staff, and we were working on the final version of the report as per the preference of the public protector. I think it took up us until later on that evening. I can't remember the time, but it should have been after 10.
And you say that the report was projected under a screen via your laptop?
Yes, there was a screen there. I think it's a TV screen or something else that we usually connect. And then we sit together and projected the report there.
Right. And you then say that the PP dictated to you and you made changes, and at some point she started typing herself.
Yes, the PP was dictating some of the changes on top of what we have, what me and Kekana has already changed in the afternoon. So she was dictating to us what to write, and at some point she took the laptop and typed herself.
Right. And then did you talk to the PP about the changes being affected at all?
Yeah, I told the PP that this is not going to look good from where I'm staying, because I think a lot of political commentators and legal experts will literally criticize us in the morning. And the PP, I presume she was in good mood. She wanted the report to go out. She just said to me in a language that Anginandab.
And what does that mean?
It basically translated, I don't care.
Okay. And after you were done?
After I was done with the PP, we had to, when you issue a report, it must have certain things that I don't know whether it's the requirement from the publishers. It needs to have ISB numbers. I had to make arrangement for us to obtain the same from the librarian who was at home. We called her. She gave it to us. And then I went to Ms. Musana's office, who will have issued a press statement and together with the report that night. And then after, when we were just sitting, because the incident of the APSA investigation was still new. It was not long. It was still fresh in our mind. And everything that we're doing, we're trying to avoid a similar incident. And after I've analyzed everything, what has happened to the report and what is being issued, I had a view that whatever that happened after the APSA investigation will happen tomorrow. Then I advised Ms. Musana not to come to work, because the last time she was attacked, she almost cried when she was interviewed by UCBS Makai's on 702. About the APSA investigation. And that's when I just offered her an advice to say, rather stay at home and see, because this will be a disaster tomorrow.
And then what was the PP's view at that stage?
No, the PP was happy initially. She thanked me for being for helping her, and it was I didn't notice anything that was abnormal about the PP. Instead, the PP, when she's happy, I will tell. When she finished her work and she's happy with what she wants to release, then obviously her mood will be in good spirit.
So in paragraph 71, you say that the PP signed the report later that night?
Yeah, she signed the report later that night when everything was in order. The ISBN numbers were we obtained and all those things.
And then you say that the final report, you detail three findings. And I just want to take you to the first finding. The final report found that the department had not infringed the regulations regarding public-private partnerships. Now, Mr. Radani, that was a legal conclusion. Where did that come from?
We requested Nemasisi to give us an opinion on this one. Remember, if you look at our memorandum of the 25th of January and all these things, we and even Mr. Ndo's initial email when the task team was formulated, it makes reference to a legal opinion regarding the triple P issues. And that's when Nemasis concluded that it was not a public-private partnership. And I think we had taken that from that opinion. And I think the PP should also have accepted the opinion.
So on that conclusion in the report, that emanated from Mr. Nemasisi's opinion that got put into the report?
Yes, that's correct.
And the report then further recorded that the officer's concurrence or the accountant general's conclusions that there had been procurement irregularities.
Yes, the accountant general report was then accepted.
Right. You then say that the February 2018 report, the final report concluded that there was gross negligence, improper conduct and maladministration in the management and monitoring of the Vrede Dairy project.
Yes, that's correct.
But that it did away with both the conclusion of financial misconduct that Mr. Nemasisi had also recommended.
Yes, that the financial misconduct issue, it was not in the final report.
Right. And that it made away with the findings of inflated prices and overcharging that have previously been there.
Yes, the finding of inflated prices was no longer there. I think this was replaced with the specific subject that talks about financial constraint and the Office of the Public Protector not being able to make such findings. And contrary to what the initial investigation team did when they were investigating or obtaining an opinion from somebody who has got the financial know-how of comparing prices.
Right. I'm going to come back to the final report in a moment. I just finish your affidavit before I take you to the final report, which we do have. The portfolio committee then raised certain concerns. And you were then instructed to reinvestigate the matter with a focus on politicians. Do you recall that? Mr. Radani, have we lost you? Mr. Radani, can you hear me?
Okay, just a pause. I think this politician thing has made him now disappear, but let's get him back. He's lost his network. He's rejoining.
this one just shows a picture.
Recording in progress.
Jenny Raidani, are you back?
Yes, I'm back, Chet.
What happened? Where did you go now?
No, I think, I don't know with my internet service provider. It goes off and on sometimes.
Let's hope
it's back for good now.
All right. Let me hand over to Advocate Bauer.
My question just before the interruption took you to paragraph 73 of your affidavit. And I said to you that the public protector was then requested to reinvestigate and to consider the role of the politicians in the Freda project.
Yes.
What were you given any instructions?
Yeah, when she came back from Parliament, she gave me an instruction to reinvestigate the matter. I think that was I think I got that it should have come from Mr. Ndou. and Mr. Mutupi. I then drafted the new investigation plans and also how are we going to what are the issues that we need to investigate in line of the criticism that we have received after the first report. And then we started with the investigation.
I just want to effect a correction. There is an error in paragraph 74 of your affidavit, and you have corrected that error by filing a further supplementary affidavit, which came through to us earlier today. Can you just tell us what that error is?
The error is in connection with the meeting that was supposed to happen. It was the public protector. It was not Mr. Ndo who was in that meeting. It was Mr. Mutupi. I've verified the information with Mr. Ndo, with both Mr. Ndo and Mr. Mutupi. They confirmed that it was Mr. Mutupi who went to the meeting with me.
Right, now just tell the committee who's Mr. Mutupi, because we haven't had his name come up yet.
Mr. Mutupi is a senior manager, was a senior manager for provincial investigation integration. So Mr. Mutupi used to report to the EM, to the executive manager, who is Mr. Ndo. And then we were senior investigators. It's myself, Matawe, and Kekana. The rest of us will then report
to.
Sorry, am I audible?
Yes, you are.
Okay. The rest of us as senior investigators will report to Mr. Mutupi. So that's why.
So that's why what? Sorry, I interrupted you.
So that's why I had to go to that meeting with the Mutupi. And in any event, if Mr. Ndo was available, he would also have formed part of the meeting. Because the investigation, even though it's allocated to an individual with me specifically, but it was allocated to the branch. So Mr. Ndo had an ultimate responsibility as the head of the branch.
Right. So what transpired? You arranged to speak to Mr. Makashulu. What happened after that?
What normally happens is when there's a minister or a politician that we want to, or let's say a director general of a department that we want to invite to a meeting, we normally subpoena that person through the Office of the Public Protector. When we did, the same happened to Mr. Makashula. We discussed it with Mr. Ndo and Mr. Mutupi that we want to subpoena Mr. Makashule, who was then the secretary, who was then now no longer the premier, but the secretary general of the ANC. And then we subpoenaed him to come and answer. And I think some of the issues that we wanted him to answer will relate like to what Mr. Nemesis here has raised in his in his comments to the reports. And I remember one of the issues that transpired, it's Mr. Makashule was the person who approved this project, and he's the one who mentioned this project in his initial State of the Nation, the province address. And for the people to go to India to benchmark and investigate and do further investigation for the implementation of this project, Mr. Makashula is the one who approved it. So then we called in the meeting. Obviously, even though it's a, the PP need to sit in that meeting regarding when you look at the nature of the person of Mr. Makhashud. Then we went to the PP board room to that meeting with Mr. Mutupi. Then the PP will normally take a lead and do the talk, much of the talking. But during the meeting, because it's an investigation meeting, we have to record it and we have to ask questions. We didn't have much of the time to ask questions. The meeting proceeded rather by Mr. Makhashule explaining to the PP what happened with the project and what did they do to try and address the issues raised by the Accountant General. And then the fact that the project is now being overseen by the Free State Development Corporation. Then that meeting did not even last for 30 minutes, because I remember the meeting of such nature may sometimes last for a day, where we are asking questions and where we are asking investigations questions. But that one did not last 30 minutes. We were then requested to excuse ourselves with Mr. Mutupi, and then the public protector requested her personal assistant or the personal assistant to bring a fresh cup of coffee, because she wanted to have a constructive meeting with the Secretary General. And it was then that we left the boardroom and we went back to our respective offices. And then the public protector remained with the Secretary General. And I'm not privy to what was discussed there in that meeting after we've been excused. And I don't know how long Mr. Makhashule remained in the office on that particular day.
And did you get a recording of the meeting?
Yes, part of our meeting, we should have recorded it. We had a recording device, so obviously I should have used my own recording device to record the meeting. But the meeting that happened between Mr. Makhashule and the public protector, obviously it was not recorded because we were not part of it.
And were you further involved in the investigation that then ensued?
No, I think that was my last engagement on this matter, because later in that year, this investigation was then, I remember together with the SA investigation, was then saved from me and allocated to other investigators. I don't know who. Basically, it should have been investigators in the main investigative branch directories, because I was not involved in the full-time investigation. We were only doing part of monitoring of provincial investigation as opposed to active investigations.
Mr. Chair, do you want to take the lunch adjournment at this point?
You've just read my mind. We will now pause for a lunch break. Mr. Raidani and everybody on the virtual platform will be back at 2. Thank you. We pause.
Recording stopped.